Well, what a great intro here for the family. We'll talk about the secret fundamentalism at the heart of American power coming up in just a second with Jeff Charlotte. Before we do, I just want to say, yes, as I had thought, there's something wrong with the punctuation program at my blog site. So everything appears as one big giant paragraph. I'll just apologize in advance. At least it does on my computer. And so if you go to the blog at coasttocoastam.com, add crypto news in it, it's just like essentially one giant run-on sentence. So I thank you in advance for sorting through that. While you're there, though, take a look at that video for the Muck Monster. Came from a TV station, and it's a great story about some kind of crypto beast. Nobody seems to know what it is. And we'll be tracking that story, I'm sure, coming up on Coast to Coast. Other great news items there at the website. And then somebody sent in a photo from Station 2 of the Mapleton Fire Department in central Pennsylvania. Thank you, William. And it's just one of those unusual photos. I'll just tell you in advance, it looks grislier than it actually is. It's of a pole that went through the engine block, then up through the hood, and then what appears to go right through the cabin of a pickup truck. In fact, if you looked at the picture too quickly, you might mistake what looks like a red left front quarter panel on a white pickup truck for being blood covered. It's not. As it turns out, the driver was not injured. But it is an amazing photograph, and you could see just how close, just an inch to the left, perhaps, and we would have been looking at a much more tragic situation. Perhaps it might not have just been a red left front quarter panel on a white pickup truck. It could have been much worse. Go take a look online for that. And while you're there, too, click onto George Norrie's new DVD trial for Dark Matter. Go take a look at that. The story behind dark matter, and then also sort of a glimpse as to what some of those movies are all about at coasttocoastam.com. And that business having been taken care of, let's jump into the story of the family. I mentioned last hour that you could almost think of the family as kind of a Protestant Opus Dei, or at least Opus Dei as it was presented in the movie The Da Vinci Code and the book by Dan Brown. But I'd like to know where Jeff Charlotte is on that, the author of The Family, The Secret Fundamentalism in the Heart of American Power. We'll talk about that. Just what is the goal of the family and how close they've already come to achieving it while nobody was watching? Next on Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. Jeff Charlotte's book, The Family, getting a lot of attention. It's already a New York Times bestseller, and it's a really good read, Jeff. So great job both on the external research and also the internal sort of accidental undercover investigation. Is
Thank
that a good
you.
way to, is that a good way to describe it? Accidental undercover investigation?
Yeah, that's really just right. The family begins with the story of a month I spent living with this group, the oldest and I think most influential religious fundamentalist organization in the United States. And I didn't go seeking to go undercover. I was doing my first book about unusual religious communities around the United States, and I was just invited in, and I said, "That sounds interesting." And suddenly I find myself really, as I say in the subtitle, at the heart of American power.
Yeah. So we'll get more into that. Let me start by a kind of a familiar door. I think for a lot of people on this was Opus Dei from the Da Vinci Code. And I was sort of using that as a way of describing it for people who didn't know what the book was about. So talk about that relatively, how close that is, a group of religious zealots that are willing to dismiss heinous acts, crimes, as long as they're committed in the name of their goals of global domination. Was that a fair way to describe the family?
I think it is. And both groups are formed in 1935. Both groups are formed by these very charismatic men with cults of personalities around them, and these guys who think that democracy is not enough. and they really venture into what I think a lot of people would say is a heresy. And both groups, the one distinction I make is that I actually give more credit to Opus Dei. One member of the family, Senator Sam Brownback from Kansas, is one of the unusual members in that he's a member of the family, and yet he also converted to Catholicism, or his version of it, that is, through Opus Dei's chapel in Washington. But he didn't join, because if you're in Opus Dei, you actually, the official rules anyway, are if you're a politician, you can't become a full member of Opus Dei, because when you do, you give veto rights over your life to the organization. And they recognize that you can't do that. If you're elected by people, you have to represent those people. You can't give veto rights to a secret organization. So the politicians don't join. The family doesn't have that barrier. Yep. And yeah. Makes them much
they're
dangerous.
Not conflicted by that problem.
They think that's a good thing. Yeah, they think
yeah.
That's a good thing.
Opus Dei looks at that as being something, no, we wouldn't want you to do that to the people, but for the family, they're like, hey, perfect.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And the other important distinction, too, is that, you know, Opus Dei is still, whether you like it or not, it's still within Catholicism. A lot of people would say it's sort of a heresy. The family is teaching something that has very little relationship to Christianity, as most of us recognize it.
Well, we'll talk more about that. And I will confess this. I got about halfway through the book. So I'm looking forward to sort of exploring that back half with you here on Coast to Coast. I loved how you set the table for the current events by going back into sort of the history of the theology of this thought of the operating ethos of this group, the family. And I will if the fact that you made this connection with Opus Dei entirely on your own doesn't surprise me. I just hadn't gotten to that part yet. So thank you for more on that. And I look forward to finishing, because it's so interesting to consider what's been going on. They would not say, the family would not say it's secret. They would just say it's private. Talk about that.
Well, actually, the word that they like to use most often is invisible.
Ah.
When I was living with them, one night I was given documents as I was sort of getting deeper into it. And it spoke of maintaining the finest invisible organization. And, I did this book by living with them and then spending years in an archive of papers that they had dumped. And so those documents are actually all there for review. Anyone can look at them. They speak of creating what they call a publicly invisible but privately identifiable group of companions, of powerful men who are bound together. And that language repeats itself over and over. The leader of this group, this man named Doug Coe, says, "We want to be like the mafia." And this is a direct quote. This is actually a sermon you can hear online. Which is not the brightest thing that they've ever done, is that the more invisible you can make your organization, the more influence it will have. So this is this word that they return to again and again, this idea of invisibility and influence.
Yeah, I kind of threw that word, the underworld, out with that in mind, the sort of fascination that they have with the mafia in the family, but also, and to make this connection again with Opus Dei, also with fascism. And I'm not saying that Opus Dei is a fascist organization, but they certainly walked hand in hand with Generalissimo Franco in the Frankist government, right, of Spain. And so it makes you wonder, when you look at, if Opus Dei was willing to make those kind of moral compromises with Franco, it's not too surprising that the folks in the family, this political organization that we'll get more into tonight on Coast to Coast, but this group sort of from the very beginning admits to a fascination with successful fascist regimes of the past, not excluding Hitler.
Yeah. Yeah. Not excluding Hitler, but especially Hitler. When I was living with the group, you know, that was the first thing that caught my attention, was a almost daily drumbeat of saying, a model for understanding Jesus, they would say, is Hitler or Stalin or Mao. They said these are evil men, but look, they were what, they, you know, Christianity's got Jesus all wrong. Jesus is actually this sort of strong man like Hitler, Stalin, and Mao. And it's funny that you mentioned Franco. This is something I didn't have room to fit in the book, but their relationship with Franco, Spain, this dictator in Spain who killed a lot of people. One thing he didn't like the family. He wasn't interested in them for a variety of reasons, until the family was able to make connection with Opus Dei associates in his government, and through those connections, build this relationship to this dictator, which then became a very fruitful relationship for them.
That notion too, and I am reminded of the Hitlerian model of these cell groups, these wolf packs, these small groups of people that were unaware, perhaps, they could be in a room of eight and four would not know that the other four were also in a group connected, that these cell groups were operating at a level that helped achieve the greater goal, but with this level of secrecy, of invisibility. So, I mean, as this organization is built from the very beginning, the family, starting in the early part of the 20th century, this idea of cells, of developing groups everywhere, all over the world, it takes hold right away. I mean, in the early years, this was part of their blueprint, and they put their blueprint to work immediately.
They really did, and you know, they began back in 1935, and when they began, it was with a specific idea. The democracy was finished. It couldn't compete with communism or fascism. They didn't want to be communists. They looked at fascism, and that seemed okay to them, but they wanted a sort of a more supernatural fascism, and they began applying that, and yet they were very successful at moving it into the mainstream, so successful that by 1942, they had a number of congressmen who were involved with the group and very openly committed to the idea that democracy was passed. We are entering what the founder of the group called the age of minority control, and that's an idea they believe in to this day. That they're not interested in democracy; they're interested in the age of minority control.
The minority
by that they mean a small group of men, not any particular ethnic group or anything like that.
And so their admiration for fascism is built on the assumption that they would be the ones at the oligarchical top of fascism. They're not the ones at the bottom. They're the ones at the top. That's how they saw their future.
They call themselves the new chosen. They believe that God has selected them for leadership and it begins one night, April 1935. This founder, a fairly prominent preacher at that point, up to that point, a fairly conventional conservative preacher, but nothing unusual or unacceptable about what he's doing. In the middle of the night, he believes that God comes to him and gives him a new revelation, saying that Christianity has gotten it wrong for 2,000 years. That Christianity has been focusing on helping the poor and the suffering and the weak and the down and out. That's not what God wants. What God wants, according to this guy, is for him to be a missionary to and for the powerful. That God announces to him, I am going to select a few powerful men, and I will work through them. And that Jesus' message was not actually meant for everybody. It was meant only for a special elite who would be given power to sort of carry it out, kind of on the rest of us.
I kind of buy that to a point. I believe that the powerful deserve a ministry just like anybody else does. It's sort of based on the same principle that, you know, hot chicks need love too. You know, I mean, that's sort of a right. I mean, there's kind of an idea that that everybody deserves to have peace and joy. But that notion gets so twisted right away, it seems, when
believe everyone deserves it. It's not that they think the powerful need a ministry too. They think the powerful are the only ones who need a ministry.
Okay.
And if you work through the powerful, that God will reveal these sort of special teachings to the powerful. And not only that God is going to give this sort of set of false teachings for the rest of us just to keep us content. I mean, this is Gnosticism. This is that old tradition of Gnosticism.
Right, the knowing ones.
Exactly.
Right.
What Plato called the noble lie, the idea that the masses can't handle the truth and that there's a certain group are going to have it, and that they're the only ones who need this direct relationship with God, and that they can then decide what's best for the rest of us. So it's a little bit of a trickle-down kind of approach to religion.
That kind of built-in elitism that was also also associated with Opus Dei. You know, don't worry, the smart people have it all here. We got it all. We got it under control. Don't worry. Everything's going to be fine. We're talking about the book The Family with Jeff Charlotte. And it explores the secret fundamentalism at the heart of American power. And we'll get into who those powerful people are and have been, who's a member of the family, and more specifically about some of these beliefs of this group, that the C Street group. But before we go there, again, let's go over a little bit more about the sort of the foundational history of the family. And the early successes came, you said, in the they had congressmen who were pretty much in their hip pocket by the early 1940s. Didn't at some point after democracy triumphed over fascism in World War II, did they not have, if you'll pardon the expression, kind of a come to Jesus meeting about the idea that maybe fascism didn't work? And hey, how about this? Democracy won.
Well, you know, one would have hoped, and in fact, but it was really in some ways just the opposite. By the end of World War II, they had enough influence in Washington that the leader of the group, Abraham Baraty, was able to sort of finagle military transport to Germany, the cooperation of the Allied government, and he went through the Allied prisons of the Nazi war criminals, interviewing them and looking for men who would be, from his perspective, suitable for not exactly rehabilitation. All they had to do was sort of switch out their allegiance to the Führer for our father, that is, not the God that you and I might be familiar with from American religion, but this very peculiar idea he had. And, you know, and among those men was a man named Baron Ulrich von Gienanth, who had been the head of the Gestapo in the United States, had been deported, had never repented for what he had done. And Abram thought this was such a good guy. He lobbied for him to get a passport in the United States. The United States would never go quite that far. So the family instead began sending him delegations of U.S. congressmen who were sort of gather around the great man's knee and learn lessons directly from Baron Ulrich von Gienanth. They look at what comes ahead. You know, World War II is over, but they look at the Cold War coming and they say, well, not time for democracy now. If anything, it's time to get tougher and time to start seeking out foreign dictators with whom we can forge these alliances.
Well, and I understand forging alliances and building an international organization, but again, you know, then they take on, if the next battle is the Cold War and communism, you would think that after, you know, the fall of the Soviet Union and the failure of the of Chinese communism to the point where they had to add in capitalism in order to make communism work in China, you would think still they would say, hey, how about this? Democracy does work. We keep betting on the wrong pony here.
Yeah, you know, it's sort of like someone is trying to teach them a lesson from above, and they're really not getting it. It's true. I mean, but that's what I think it really reveals, the fundamental nature of the group. And here I'm just using their own language. I do, when writing about different sorts of beliefs, it's important to really not characterize them for them, but to look at what they believe. They look at the New Testament, and where most of us would read the New Testament and see a message of love or mercy or justice or forgiveness, whether or not we're Christians, that's, you know, I think most of us recognize that, they really believe that what the New Testament is about is power. When I began reporting this book, I actually sat in on a counseling session between the leader of the group and a congressman from Kansas named Todd Tehart. And Todd Tehart came in with a sort of pretty standard set of issues that he was concerned about. And the leader of the group said, no, you've got to put that away. He says, what we want is a covenant between powerful men who are bound together by serving God. And I said, now, you may think you know who God is, but let me explain to who God is. He says, look at Hitler. Look at Pol Pot. Osama bin Laden, Lenin, that's what we're going for. That model of strength, the power cult.
Wow. Well, then, who is in the family? Who do we know has been in the family historically? Who is in there now? The Secret Fundamentalism at the Heart of American Power. That's the subtitle of the new book from Jeff Charlotte. And then when we return to the subject, I want to talk about the crimes. You know, I don't want to toss that around and not back that up. So what are the things that the family feels were sort of justifiable crimes, or even just philosophically, if X were to happen, it wouldn't be so bad as long as it was in the name of Christ, or at least the Christ that they believe is the one that they are entitled to, the one that they would worship, the powerful Christ, the kind of fascist Christ that Hitler would have imagined as well. The family, the secret fundamentalism at the heart of American power, coming up next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Jeff Charlotte's book chronicles this hardcore group of both Republicans and some Democrats that live in one particular house in Washington, D.C., but also congregate in various retreats around the world, have what would appear to be kind of a shadow organization going directly to the heads of states of other countries, doing their own kind of diplomacy negotiations on the side based on these relationships of the family. And even when they've done something like violate their marriage vows with a prostitute or with an affair with a woman that they were obviously not only not married to, but also, you know, in some cases kind of throwing under the bus afterward, the family, you know, just circles the wagons. They protect their own. And they don't see this as being a particularly big problem, these kind of petty hypocrisies. Not when one looks at the big picture ahead and what they're achieving. We'll talk about that and some of the very specific members involved with this, up to this point, invisible organization called The Family. Next with Jeff Charlotte, who names names on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Jeff Charlotte's book, The Family, certainly stirring up trouble for what had been a private/secret, hoped to be invisible organization of Christian fundamentalists that were part of their own, you know, mandate would say, try to control the world, to try to be the ones at the top of the power pyramid as they feel like they have had these private revelations as to what the purpose of God and or religion is all about. In fact, before we go any further into who, again, lay out, if you could, the beliefs. What is it that they believe that their unique revelation tells them? What's the difference between their God and, say, my God?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that, because although, you know, on the surface they might look like a Christian fundamentalism, I've actually been really heartened by the fact that I've been joined in investigating them by some very prominent Christian right figures, a magazine called World Magazine, a Christian right magazine. And building on my research just this past month, they've launched their own investigation. And I think what they are finding, Christian fundamentalists are looking at this group and saying, hey, this isn't Christianity. This is a power cult. This is this group that has this idea that God had a sort of set of special secret teachings for the very powerful few, the new chosen, as they call themselves, and that they're modeled not on love or mercy or any of these kinds of good things that most of us think of as part of religion, but on this really just bald fetishization for power, for authoritarianism, and that's why the family constantly invokes as leadership models, these horrible figures like Hitler and Mao. Doug Coe, the leader of the group, he says, you think you understand Jesus? Let me tell you what I mean by Jesus. He says, you know how Jesus said you got to put me before your mother, father, brother, sister. This is a scripture verse. He says, well, Hitler and Mao, that's what they taught the kids. Mao even had the kids killing their own parents, but it wasn't murder, you see, because it was for building the new nation. It was for building the new kingdom.
And that's a quote. And that's a quote.
That's a direct quote. Actually, I did a segment on this with NBC Nightly News last year, and The Family, which very rarely responds to anything, did put forth a spokesman who tried to defend that kind of language by saying, well, you know, we just use Hitler as a metaphor. And you want to say, you can't think of a better metaphor for Jesus than Hitler? Let's start with a lamb, perhaps.
Right. Bible is full of metaphors for Jesus.
I don't think Hitler's in there. Well, I'll go back and check, but I'm pretty sure he's not in there.
That's scary. So again, though, their version is that God is has this new chosen, this new power elite, and that they are ordained to do whatever they feel is necessary to bring this vision of what they feel God is calling them to do into reality.
Yeah, and another way that they differ from what we might call Christian fundamentalism, the way that they're not, is, you know, there's this idea very popular among some people that that Christ might be coming back any day. They don't believe that. The core group doesn't believe that. They believe that the particular Christ who that they are interested in, again, not recognizable. I want to emphasize that to all, you know, our Christian listeners out there. We're not talking about your God. We're talking about something very different. This God, though, doesn't come back until they've established 1,000 years of government according to his order through them. So they've got a long, long-term project, and that justifies an any means necessary approach to politics.
1,000 years. Where have I heard that before? 1,000 years. 1,000 years of a
bell, doesn't it?
Of a Reich government. Yeah, 1,000. Funny how that really is interesting. They really are kind of obsessed with this sort of Hitlerian model then, that there would be 1,000 years of their rule, and then God would come back?
Yeah, well, I mean, even in the early days, they said, you know, back in the early days, they were a little more plain about the relationship to fascism. They said, we are seeking a fascist dictatorship for God. And even now, they still speak in terms of what they sometimes call the totalitarianism of Christ. And any serious Christian person hears that phrase, and they say, that makes no sense. There's no totalitarianism is anti-Christian. Christ isn't totalitarian. Christ is loving, right? So, you know, they take the sort of the veneer of a world religion, which has this great tradition, but they bend it toward this very ugly, very darkest conception of power.
So now, with that fresh in our minds, let's talk about the people who we know both historically and in current events that are at the heart of the family, people who would not renounce their relationship with the family, people who would attribute their success to the family. Who would those be?
It's a surprising list, but let's start with the three who put the family in the news this summer. Senator John Ensign of Nevada, Governor Mark Sanford of South Carolina, and Congressman Chip Pickering of Mississippi. Three men who, to the public, have long proclaimed their commitment to small-ass family values, you know, being honest and being forthright and, a certain kind of moral standard. And as we learned this summer, we're all carrying on secret affairs and really pretty awful secret affairs, except Governor Sanford. He fell in love. He says he's a different case.
Right. It's his soulmate, dude.
It's his soulmate. We don't want to bust on him, right? But what disturbed at is that they're all linked to a ministry that the family runs called the C Street House in Capitol Hill. This is a former convent. They register as at a church, even though the leader of the group says he hates church. But what that allows them to do is be tax exempt, and then they can provide below market housing to congressmen, just like a lobbyist. And Senator Ensign has been living there for 7 years. I met him there. Governor Sanford went for counseling with his affair, and of course they helped him cover it up. Senator Ensign, we now learn through his brothers in the C Street House, managed to cover up his affair for months or maybe a year. They actually, according to allegations, encouraged him to pay off his mistress, to pay for her silence, to pay her husband. I mean, this comes awfully close to what we would call pimping. But the family considered that justified because Senator Ensign, and from their perspective, has been chosen for power by God. So anything we need to do to protect him, they'll do. The worst was really Congressman Chip Pickering of Mississippi. And, you know, people out there might say, hey, that's my representative, I like him, and so on. We're not talking about their public records. We're talking about what they do behind closed doors. Pickering, according to his wife, who's filing for divorce, Mississippians know this. She's been a long-suffering woman. She's finally fed up with her husband's womanizing. Pickering wasn't just using the C Street House to cover up his affair. He was actually conducting his affair in the C Street House, this building right there in Capitol Hill, registered as a church, this $2 million townhouse. So these three guys have been in the news, but they've been helped by some others. Senator Tom Coburn of Oklahoma was allegedly the man who advised Senator Ensign that he should pay his mistress's family $1.2 million.
Right.
You know, the list goes on.
Well, let's go to James Inhofe, who's also from Oklahoma, isn't he?
Indeed, yeah. Oklahoma's got a bit of a track
right.
record
so
with this organization.
Both of their senators are in the family.
And Senator Don Nichols, before them, was involved. Representative Steve Largent, who was also from Oklahoma. A lot of these guys, Senator Sam Brownback from Kansas, allowed me actually to spend time with him. I also write for Rolling Stone magazine, and so I traveled with Brownback for Rolling Stone magazine in Washington and Kansas. And his whole career has been made through the family from when he was a young guy first coming to Washington, needed a place to stay, and the family said, "Here, we'll set you up." And
right.
they had their hooks in from very early on.
Then let's go. Let's go. Then we got Senator Tom Coburn, Senator John Ensign. Who did we mention? And we mentioned Inhofe.
But Jim DeMint also, Senator Jim DeMint from South Carolina has been living in the C Street House for many years. He says it's a way of providing accountability. But then we got to ask what kind of accountability happens behind closed doors. And they really do say that. Congressman Zach Womp of Tennessee has been living at the C Street House for 12 years. Says, well, we have to keep it secret. He actually told when all this came out this summer, he says, we have to keep it secret because no one would be involved if it wasn't secret. So we have to go behind closed doors.
Don't they get that? That that's just like any criminal organization. Well, if people knew we were in it, we couldn't be in it. I mean, it just doesn't make it. I mean, that should be like a little red flag that goes.
Exactly. And you got to say, you know, wait a minute, you have to keep it secret. Are you telling me because the American people won't support a politician they feel has a good relationship with God? I don't think so.
That's not the problem. That's not the problem.
Exactly. These guys, because what they realize, and this is what happened with this Christian Right magazine, which I have great admiration for, called World Magazine. They did an investigation. They called up all these politicians who you would think would be thrilled to be in this magazine. They said, tell us about your relationship. And they all said, we can't speak about it. And that's because, according to the family's own documents, when you enter into what they call a cell, you sign you pledge yourself to an oath of secrecy. You don't speak about what your brothers in the cell do, even if, as in the case of Senator Ensign and Governor Sanford and so on, they're betraying the public trust. Senator Ensign, we now know, may have actually committed a felony. There's going to be an investigation and its misuse of campaign funds to cover up his affair. And his brothers not only didn't speak about it, they helped him cover it up.
Okay. So the first rule of Fight Club is
yes.
never talk about Fight Club. So Tom Coburn, John Ensign, Jim DeMint, we mentioned Brownback. Steve Largent,
Todd Hart from Kansas, Joe Pitts from Pennsylvania, Frank Wolf from Virginia, Robert Atterhall from Alabama. It's sounding at this point, some people out there saying, hey, this sounds like all Republicans. I hope this guy isn't bashing Republicans, and I am certainly not. There's Democrats involved too. Senator Mark Pryor of Arkansas has been involved, although now he is denying it. Congressman Bart Stupak, Democrat of Michigan, has been living in the family's C Street house for 7 years. And now when the scandal broke, the Michigan press said, hey, what's this all about? And he says, gee, I don't know. He's been getting below market housing, basically subsidized housing from this group for 7 years, living in the house. And I've been in the house. I know what goes on in that house. And he's now claiming that he basically closed his eyes and plugged his ears whenever he was there for 7 years, even though back in 2002, he told the Los Angeles Times, when they asked him about his involvement, he says, oh, it's secret. I can't tell you.
I saw on a list Norm Coleman, the former senator from Minnesota, and he's Jewish.
Yeah, I don't, you know, unfortunately, sometimes people take my research and run with it. I don't know anything about Norm Coleman, so I wouldn't say anything about that.
But I do. I know him. And so it surprised me when he was listed as a former resident at C Street.
Oh, I don't believe he is. No, I think that's a mistake. I think,
right.
Well, you know, one of the things that I'm very careful with in this research, and I think is very important, We have in the United States a history of something called McCarthyism, you know, where people start throwing allegations around widely. And
right.
So I don't describe anyone as involved in this unless, say, as in the case of Senator Ensign, I've spent time with him at the C Street House, or Congressman Tehart. I sat in and I listened to him on a session where he was learning about this, or former Attorney General Ed Meese, who runs a weekly meeting there, or working through the family's own archive, 600 boxes of documents. If I have documentation, then I can say, hey, this person's involved. Here is the papers.
Right.
Senator Chuck Grassley of Iowa, I have documents going back to the 80s of him meeting with a dictator named Siad Barre, who was the dictator of Somalia, and doing so on behalf of the family. Senator Jim Inhofe, there's actually a little video you can see online where he talks about how he uses his status as a senator to sort of open doors overseas and not represent American interests, but to represent what he calls, quote, the political philosophy of Jesus. A lot of people would say Jesus' philosophy is not political. They say the political philosophy of Jesus as taught to him by Doug Coe, and he does so on the public dime. He actually brags about using funds of the U.S. Senate Armed Services Committee, money that is supposed to be there for looking out for the interests of the men and women in our fighting forces. He's using that to promote this very private, very unusual agenda overseas.
We're talking about The Family, the new book out by Jeff Charlotte, The Secret Fundamentalism at the Heart of American Power. I wikied that the C Street Group, which was one of the places that the family has a residence that is open to members, the other being the Cedars, and we'll talk more about that coming up in the next hour. But when I went to Wiki, it said Susan Collins has been a resident at C Street. And I thought C Street was a male-only thing.
This is really, I think what's happening now, unfortunately, is some people are, whether they have a political
an agenda
with a certain politician,
right,
are trying to tar him by association. The other thing that's happening is,
yeah, but Susan Collins, I mean, she's like one of the most liberal Republicans.
She's very moderate, and she's
fit.
A woman, and the C Street House,
right?
I mean, you have even Michael Cromartie, who's a Christian conservative guy, but honest on this score, at least, says the C Street House is like a fundamentalist rat house. Susan Collins is not welcome.
Where you could bring your girlfriend.
Well, you can bring a girlfriend or your mistress, exactly.
That just doesn't make any sense. And in fact, I wondered about that at the time when you were talking about Pickering bringing in his mistress, according to the divorce papers with his wife, and didn't some of the members? What's that?
That hasn't been denied. I mean,
that hasn't been denied.
Yeah.
But I mean, you didn't in the case of John Ensign, senator from Nevada. Wasn't it some of the guys in C Street Group in the family tried to talk him out of it? Said you really don't want to do this. You want to stop this. He didn't right away, but they were encouraging him on a 1-to-1 basis to drop his girlfriend. Is that right? Does that sound right?
Yes, that's right. But you got to put that in the context in which they say even if you don't, you still deserve to be in power. And I hear the music, so maybe I can give you a little context on the other side.
All right, we'll do context on the other side, coming up with Jeff Charlotte. And we'll talk about that. The consequences of breaking the rules, and how is one chosen? When I talk about the members of the family, this Christian-inspired political organization, they consider themselves the new chosen, which gives them all sorts of latitude in what they feel like they can do, both with their role as a servant of the people, but also as a servant of the world, and what they can do, what kind of arrangements they can make, what they feel like is in their purview. How are they chosen? What does one do in order to be revealed as one of the new chosen? We'll talk about that too, and we'll get back to the subject of some of the other crimes next too on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett.